these writers are brilliant storytellers and courageous literary adventurers, setting out to do something new and more ambitious with each of their novels. Both also write absolutely beautiful prose. I'm tempted to read you passages from both these books, but I'll leave that privilege to them. Joe's last book, Star of the Sea, sold a million copies, was published in 26 languages, and won a number of prizes, including Ireland's Hennessy Sunday Tribune Literary Award, the Prix Littéraire Européen Madeleine Zetter Prize for European Novel of the Year, and the Irish Post Award for Fiction. In Redemption Falls, Joe wonderfully carries forward the story of the famine ship Star of the Sea arriving in New York, now telling a large, rich tale of Irish lives and loves, struggles and triumphs towards the end of the American Civil War. In addition to Zoli, Colin McCann has written Dancer, a superb novel about Nereida, This Side of Brightness, and the story collections Fishing the Slow Black River and Everything in This Country Must, and he received Ireland's Rooney Prize for Literature. A beautiful short film he made with a friend of the title story in Everything in This Country Must was nominated for an Academy Award in 2005.
No, I don't think so.
Special thanks to Miss Betsy Bradley for all her wonderful work in organizing this evening's program, and to Glucksman's Ireland House at New York University for co-sponsoring it. I believe we have Joe Lee from Ireland House who's here tonight, and also would like to welcome the Consul General of Ireland, Niall Burgess, his wife. Please watch for the announcement of our spring program season. If you're not already on our email list, there are sheets at the door as you leave. You can sign up to get notice of what we'll be doing in the future. The events this winter spring will include two more conversations with novelists, the Welsh poet and novelist Owen Shears and the American Jeff Talarico. And on April 21st, a fabulous evening about newspaper column writing with Michael Kinsley, Maureen Gowd, and Frank Rich, moderated by former Cohen Center Fellow Sean Lentz. Colin and Joe have generously agreed to sign their books, which will be on sale just outside the doors as you leave the auditorium. Once they finish talking in about an hour, please let them go to the back of the auditorium where you can buy the books and ask all of your follow-up questions there. It was a tremendous pleasure to have both of these men as part of the Cohen Center's ongoing love affair with Irish writers, and I hope that you'll both come back anytime you like.
Thank you. Thank you. Can I borrow that? Thank you so much, Gene. It's nice to be back, Joe, huh?
It is.
Shall we stay? He brought his tent. I have sleeping bags, and we're just going to stay the whole time anyway. Some idiot wrote this about Redemption Falls about a year ago. Redemption, this is what we're going to talk about tonight. We're going to talk about this book, Redemption Falls, because I've already talked about Zoli here, and I think that this is like appropriate to talk about this enormous book. Redemption Falls is a gem. It's a glorious book, enormous, virtuoso, brave. Its scope is wide, love, death, war, belonging, and yet its gaze is intimate. At its heart is a story of a woman who wants to return to the only country she has, her family. The language is at turns bawdy, ancient, poetic, grand, and funny. One can't dismiss this genius that's involved in being able to tell such necessary stories in a time of war and still be able to beat back all the clichés. The minute I finished the book, I wanted to start reading it all over again. That was me. I went back to it again yesterday and today. I think the mark of a truly, truly great book is the echoes it brings back into your life. And you remember actually where you were physically when you read particular passages and how they come back. And so it's an honor to present Joe. We're going to talk and talk and talk and talk. Try and shut us up after an hour. That'll be fun. But he's going to read for 5 minutes, and then we're going to sit down and have a conversation. And then we're going to open it up for questions too. Thank you for inviting me back to the library, and it's a pleasure to be here with Joe O'Connor. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. It's lovely to be back here at the library again. I feel as relaxed as if I was in my front room at home. And we have two young kids, so that isn't always very relaxed, but you know what I mean. I spoke to James today, who Gene was kind enough to mention, and he's very sad not to be here drinking the sodas. But he told me that while I've been away on the book tour, they had a little exercise in school. They had to fill out a questionnaire part of a reading project, and one of the questions was, where is your favourite place to read books? And he wrote, of course, the New York Public Library. So, I thank Jean and... Yes, of course. I thank Jean and Betsy and everybody, Pamela and Adriana at the centre, and of course our friends from Ireland House, my publishers, Free Press, from Simon & Schuster, who are here tonight, and I thank them deeply for publishing the book. And I think I see lots of friends here tonight. You all clean up very well, I must say. So thank you for being here. So this is from the opening of Redemption Falls, and I won't explain it, I'll just read it. It's the opening few pages. Chapter 1, Motherless Child. A year in the life of Eliza Duane Mooney. Her leave-taking, the strangeness of time, a fat man, Little Rock, John Corey and his family, the lustful preacher. The quarter light was rising as she hurried out from Baton Rouge, through the criminal districts of town, then the black section, then the Irish, past the clustered Union sentries on the Telegraph Road, the maws of federal cannons ranked and aimed toward the north, then onward over the viaduct into barricaded swampland where once, not long ago, the slaves had toiled. It was January the 17th, 1865. The end of the war was coming. Walking away from a scalping shack, the grits of the road on road-skinned soles, grind of the shingles into lacerated arches, dazzle of pain, the cramps to the hamstrings, and the hopeless prayers for shoes. It took her almost a month to slog across Louisiana, 15 miles a day, 26,000 paces. A soldier, victualled and booted, might have deserted at such a burden. Eliza Duane Mooney did not. She had not been long walking when it started to happen. Everything was coming to merit attention. A rice field, two flies, a dead chicken hawk in a gully, the eyes of hungry alligators, resentful in the slime. All of it seemed equal, which is one definition of madness. The weight of the world had lost proportion. There were days when she hobbled until the world began to shimmer. The sky billowed around her like the folds of apocalypse, and the white-hot egg of pain in her breast threatened to crack with a seepage of venom. She would lie wherever she fell, gaping up at the crows, would crawl from the road if she was able. Whatever burned to hatch must be palliated by stillness. She came to believe it could hear her. Riders went by, or wagons full of men. Nobody stopped. Perhaps they did not see her. This is what she would tell herself as she shivered in the ditches. I am becoming invisible now. April comes in. Time is moving strangely. The tenses grow confused. In her bundle, a storybook, dilapidated, spine cracked, and a canister of medicinal foot powder and a crumpled letter. The powder proved a waste of her last 4 cents. She suspects it is nothing but pestled down chalk. She may as well rub in the cinders of the road for all the alleviation it brings. The Redeemer never wrote, only once in the dust, never put nothing on paper. Walked 1,500 miles out of Palestine, Texas, howled many a field holler on the way. He was hip-shot at Gettysburg, blinded in the wilderness, torched alive at Shiloh, gutted at Manassas, and he shrieked the rebel yell as they diced for his uniform, Mother, why have you forsaken me? Sometimes by moonlight or when she pauses to rest, she takes out the storybook and riffles its pages. The feel of the flimsies Eliza finds comforting, more than the words stained onto them. Thou shalt not kill, I shall cause them to fall. Their carcasses will I give to be meat for the fowls. If you counted all the words in that thick, rustling book, they would be fewer than the dead of the war. And some of those who died were Ephesians or Jerusalems, Maccabees and Canaanites, Golgothas and Samaritans. But most were only ands and ifs and yees, small and unmemorable, devoid of authority, only significant for the matters they link, never worth quoting or immortalizing in a place name, because those are the ones that will always do the dying when it comes a time of war. And you wouldn't really miss them until you tried to speak, at which point you would find yourself struck by the absence that is felt between those who love or hate, or sensed in the oceans of the self. The wanted word is somehow not here. It was murdered, edited out of the inheritance. What you say instead is what you know how to say, and not what you would like to, the truth. When it rained, she was drenched. On hot days, she burned. Time continued moving in ways she did not understand. A minute takes an hour on hard Scrabble Road, but a morning skitters by if you're resting. Often she thinks of a story her mother used to tell. The fiddler, inveigled by a fairy woman on the road into Connemara, who enters her wrath, plays for her a single night. But when he stumbles out at dawn, blinking, love drunk, he finds 10 years have passed. You can lose you a life in a single night. Mamo's stories were facts, not fancies. Glintings in the distance, what can they be? Are stars raining down on the land like frogs? As she nears to the flickers, she sees what is happening, a sight she must be imagining. Carters heft sheets of glass from a wagon, roughly, hurriedly. The odd pane falls and breaks. The overseer shrieks that they are not to be broken. They cost the master $1 a dozen. They are passed hand to hand along a chain of men who are spackling them into the ribs of a greenhouse. She stops, she watches, plates of shining glass, and each bears the face of a soldier. They must be the ones who did not come back, who never returned to pay the photographer. Farmers, husbands, old men, boys. The sun burns hard through their reticent smiles. In a year, they will be all burned away. There we are. We might read a few other bits and pieces later, but we'll see.
As we go along, we've got some ballads to do and things like that. I want to get right to the heart of the matter. You quote Walt Whitman, and he says that the real war will never get in the books. Mm-hmm. Then I found a quote by Natalia Ginsberg, and she says that as soon as one writes, one miraculously ignores the current circumstances of one's life. Yet our happiness or misery leads us to write in a certain way. When we're happy, our imagination is more dominant. And when we're miserable, the power of memory takes over. Now, it seems to me that there's a sort of interweaving between those two quotes that sort of gets into this novel. Because in many ways, the real war does get into these books. And it's you looking back and having that distance.
Well, people sometimes forget the second part of that quote. You know, Whitman said the real war will never get in the books, but he added, perhaps it would be better if it didn't, because he felt that, you know, America had been so traumatized by this terrible thing that it had done to itself. You know, such a young, beautiful country. Whitman had worked as a nurse in the war. He had seen the sufferings of the soldiers close up, and he almost kind of seemed to advocate a kind of collective amnesia as a sort of healing, which I think in some ways, you know, certainly when you're Irish, that has moments when it becomes attractive, because of course what we did in Ireland with our history, with our civil war, which we had in the 1920s, was remember it so ardently that, you know, our entire political culture up until very recently was based on it, and the two conservative parties who take it in turns to be in government in Ireland pretty much replicate the Civil War divisions, although it is changing now. So I was interested in that. I was also interested in the kind of formal implications that the Whitman quote would lead you to, because, of course, what that means is that you can't tell the story of war, I think, in one voice. It can't be about one character. It can't be even in one tense. You've got to find all sorts of points from which to shine the light.
You call it multifaceted, noisy, jostling with facts, messing around.
I hope so, yeah. And that, so that in some sense, I mean, it's a risky thing to do, you know, to say that you're going to make the opening chapters of your book deliberately confusing, you know, is a very risky strategy, and you have to trust that readers will trust you to know what you're doing. Right. And my hope is that 50 or 100 pages into the book, the reader has begun to see what is going on. I mean, this book is basically, it's a scrapbook. You realize in the course of it that it's a collection of documents being put together by somebody. You're not right. sure at first, but then it becomes obvious who that is. So this is a collection of documents compiled by a man who has an obsessive interest in the four or five characters who form the action of the book.
And you only reveal that, I mean, we're not going to give too much away to reveal yeah. that, you only really reveal that at the end.
Well, you only reveal exactly who he is at the end. But, I mean, I hope there's a sense that a different person would put the documents together sure. in a different way, and that that's saying something about history, how much we can know about it, if anything.
Right.
So, you know, but as I say, it's a risky thing to do. So I've been relieved that, you know, readers have understood what the project was.
And then did it get to the war now? Because wherever we are now is where we were then. And so was the, you know, the political circumstances of today, did they influence how you chose to write about the then?
Well, I think so. I mean, I don't really like the kind of historical fiction that is just a kind of chronicling of things. You know, I think that is what belongs in the museum. And there is a certain kind of historical fiction that's sort of very carefully researched, and, you know, you suddenly come across a passage where, you know, the author has discovered somewhere in his research, is probably in the New York Public Library, a really fascinating article about the kind of shoes that people wore in 1861, and feels that he has to tell you all about it. So the action kind of slows down, and we have a PowerPoint presentation, and then, you know, when that's done, we go back to it. And there's often a lot about inadequate dentistry in historical novels, and awful surgical procedures that were ghastly. And, you know, so I think you have to be really tough on yourself, and you have to do all the research, and you have to try and get, if you're making reference to a historical background, you have to try and get it right. But I think there does come a point when you have to sort of throw your notes away and just trust your imagination to filter in and out what is actually useful for a fictional experience, which is a different experience.
Sure.
And it works in a different space. So, you know, you have to try and get it right, but not worry about it too much. I mean, I had an example of the danger, I suppose, with my last book, Star of the Sea, where I used some of the same techniques. One of the things that a historical novelist has to watch out for always is anachronisms, you know, making people say things or think things or know things that they couldn't have known. And I have a scene in the opening chapter of Star of the Sea where Pius Mulvey, the central character in that book, a poor man emigrating from Connemara in 1847, and he's standing on the ship, and it's the last of Ireland. He's looking at the last little islands disappearing into the night, and it's awful. So I thought, just to sort of sophisticate the scene a bit emotionally, I would give him one sort of nice, warm memory. So I decided that when Pius was a little lad, there was a kindly schoolmaster in Connemara who taught them a little mnemonic device for remembering the sequence of planets from the sun. And the device was, Mary's violet eyes make John sit up nights praying. And that was, you know, my nice little moment. So the book came out. A fellow wrote to me from the Irish, you know, Astrological Society, and said, well, we have a problem,
right.
because praying is Pluto, and Pluto was discovered in 1920. So this guy, you know, who's, in fact, I read over this summer that we're still not absolutely sure whether Pluto exists at all.
Maybe not a planet.
So, yeah, so the book became successful, so it was reprinted, so I took it out. Mary's violet eyes make John sit up nights. And then the same guy, very cruelly, he could have told me this the first time, he wrote back to me. He said, well, we still have a problem because N is Neptune, and Neptune was discovered in 1847. So you have this poor illiterate man standing on the ship. Like, is he reading the scientific journals, you know? So it seemed with every reprint of the book, the solar system was getting smaller. And, you know, there's another one. There's a very poignant scene I shouldn't be laughing at, of a poor fella, again, dying on a mountainside in Connemara, and he hears a wolf howling in the distance. And a guy seriously wrote to me from kind of the Irish Wolf Appreciation Society saying that couldn't have happened because it's a matter of record that the last wolf in Ireland was shot in 1802. Oh. And here's a drawing of the wolf, and here's an account of who shot him. And at my father's instigation, I wrote back to that man and said, well, that must have been the second last wolf, because the last one is there.
It's there so, in
you know,
the book.
Yeah, so you have to be very careful with all of those things, because they're out there waiting for you. And with a subject like the American Civil War, I suspect they're out there waiting in great number, battalions indeed. You know, so.
Now, things do, they can get diseased with research, you know, like people, yeah. You know, you get into a novel and then suddenly, like, somebody wants to say, well, they're wearing Homburg hats in Harlem in the 1923s. Then I have to put in the fact that... Whereas really writers of fiction are more interested in texture than fact. And see, facts, it strikes me, are mercenary things. You can pack them up wherever the hell you want them to go. And, you know, they can be shipped off and they can create wars. And we've seen this even over the last 5 years.
Yeah.
You know, facts can be manipulated. But the job of the novelist is to create texture. And it seems to me that what you do most extraordinarily is that you create this sort of, this wild, fantastic, kaleidoscopic texture with songs. I'd love if you did one of the ballads actually now, like from the book.
Well,
don't sing it.
I'm not going to sing it, but
my wife says to me, she says, you do sing, but you can't.
Yeah. Well, James, who is quickly becoming the star of this evening, you know, if he hears me singing in the shower, he comes and closes the bathroom door, you know, so that's how well I can sing. But no, I'll read one of the ballads in a minute.
But it seems to me that really what you get at is an absolute, it seems to me to be an entirely honest texture. And whether or not you're true to the facts, I'd like to talk about that and the research at the New York Public Library. And, you know, what is factual and what's not, how you choose. Are you a magpie, you know, in relation to that?
Well, I mean, what I think is that, you know, at the heart of the fictional experience, that sort of very privileged relationship that exists between writer and reader is something very old in us, which is play, you know? It's a game.
Right.
You are saying to the reader, come with me on this journey. And we know that it's make-believe. You know, people aren't idiots. You know, they know that if they want the researched, correct textbook facts, they will look elsewhere. But there's something about fiction. There's something about temporarily knowing what it's like to be somebody else that helps us to know what it's like to be us. And so if you go on that, if you offer that make-believe journey, people will sometimes come on it with you. And one of the ways you do it is with texture and music. I mean, it's the thing that I didn't like about my own early books, and perhaps one of the reasons that I tried to change the way I was writing is that I felt I was kind of missing a trick. You know, I don't think it's enough to tell a story. It's not enough to have engaging characters. The prose itself needs to be beautiful. And when you're writing about dark subject matter, which I did with the Irish famine and now with the American Civil War, you know, your book better have music. It better have light somehow. And, you know, one of the ways that you do that is by setting up maybe the idea that each character has their own music. There's the wonderful stuff when you're writing about the 1860s of different forms of American English. Precisely at this moment when the country is tearing itself to pieces, immigrants are arriving, enriching, you know, the American language with their own words. So it seemed like a no-brainer that, you know, part of this book is going to have to be written using those forms and that wonderful kind of symphonic approach.
That's a great word.
So that it's just beautiful. You know, I think your first duty is for it to be beautiful. And after that,
absolutely,
it can be political or, you know, it can, I mean, being beautiful is itself quite a political thing to do, I think. So, you know, you have to try and use every strategy that you possibly can.
Being beautiful is a political strategy?
Yeah,
that's the first. And write that one down.
Well, I think it is, yeah. I think there's enough ugliness in the world, you know.
Right.
And to try and create something beautiful is to change the world.
Right.
And
you're talking about the way words bump up against each other on the page as the creation of a piece of beauty that is then read and musicked by the reader.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think Anthony Cronin, you know, that Irish writer who I like very much.
Well, Dead as Doornails.
Dead as Doornails, yeah. But he says in one of his in one of his pieces of journalism somewhere that, you know, every young writer in particular, you should want to change the world. You know, it should come as a slow disappointment to you that maybe you're not going to, but that should be the aim.
Right.
And in a way, you know, when I think about my own life, I'm somebody who's interested in politics. I've been active in politics, and I still am. But some of the most radical and fundamental changes come in that sort of very private, intimate space of the reader and the book, you know, and you need to be aware of that when you're writing fiction. The thing about the ballads, I think Irish ballads are a very interesting form because they appear to be so economical. People will know, you know, the opening line of an Irish ballad is often an invitation to come and gather around, you know, come all ye.
Come all ye.
And I'm going to tell you the story. That's verse one. Verse two and three and four is the story. Verse five is the conclusion. Usually that the English are terrible, and then, you know. So it seems to be a remarkably efficient storytelling strategy, which it is. But, of course, you know, it doesn't leave much room for the grey. You know, its very efficiency is sometimes the problem. So I have a section in the book which, I mean, there's a lot of music all through the book, but there's one section of the book which is almost, it's told in ballads, and it's looking at how Irish and Scottish and English ballads entered the American tradition, became Appalachian songs, became cowboy hero songs. And that's a very interesting process, you know, that depending on who's writing the song, the subject of it is either hero or villain. You know, that they're actually works of propaganda often, rather than kind of, they're certainly works of art rather than unmediated experience.
I remember reading them and thinking, these are so bawdy and fantastic. Did he really make them up himself?
They're all made up. I'm not going to read a bawdy one just because...
No.
I'll do that in the pub later at around midnight. I'll read one. There's a character in the book called Cole MacLaurenson, who is an Irish Confederate. And at the end of the war, he becomes a bandit. He becomes an outlaw, and he has many pseudonyms, and one of them is Johnny Thunders, and he becomes a sort of folk hero to some, and I guess a terrorist to others. And there are many songs like that, you know, in the Western American tradition, and I'll read one. The song that was in the back of my mind when I was writing this is a very, very old Irish poem, The Lament for Art O'Leary. Well, Dermot Bulger's version is The Lament for Arthur Cleary, which is written in, I think, about 1980. So this very, very old lament poem is still very much part of the culture. It's a woman lamenting for her dead lover. So I'll just read this. It's called The Criolla's Lament for Johnny Thunders. You have to imagine that I'm singing it, because one of the problems with reading these things is that they have a sing-song rhythm, which isn't very sophisticated, but I'll read it to you anyway. The Criolla's Lament for Johnny Thunders. Out early I rode in the groves of Dakota, all early I rode in the dawn of the day, when I heard a dark lady tenderly weeping, O whither my Johnny so gallant and gay. And handsome and hopeful my Johnny so tender, and valiant and strong as the sun in the west, and false-hearted lawman that chased him to Kansas, and merciless marshal put the lead in his breast. Come all ye brave cowboys that rides on the mountain, come bold bandolero and motherless son, the hope of the widow, the scourge of the landlord, he lived by his lights and he died by the gun. All hopeful and handsome, my Johnny so tender, and gallant and gay as a star of the night, he stole from the rich and he gave to the hungry, and never a lady received any slight. A dagger of silver he wore in his buckle, he rode with a chain all the many miles long, and every link held a heart that was broken of a girl he had spurned for the love of his own. He said he would wed me in Galveston, Texas. Through Galveston, Texas, now lonely I search. He said he would buy me a bunch of green ribbons for to tie in my tresses by St. Mary's Church. All early I rode in the groves of Dakota. The innocent birds whistled hymns to the day. And I'll never forget her, that vision of sorrows, who wept for her outlaw, turned weeping away. Weeping away, weeping away, who wept for her outlaw, turned weeping away. Then ghostly she vanished, that ebony phantom, as thoughts of old loves at the dawn of the day. We'll all be singing that later.
something we wouldn't talk about when we're, or maybe we would if we were sitting down in the pub later tonight. I mean, what are we up to with the Irish novel? I mean, it seems to me, I get asked, you know, why are you, you know, writing about Slovak gypsies who are like walking across Europe, or, you know, Russian ballet dancers, and, you know, and I think, well, you know, it's been my charge in certain ways to try to expand the boundaries of the Irish novel. Mm. And you certainly have done that, and it seems to me that there's something going on. There's two parts to this question. What's going on with the Irish novel? Why are we abroad, or why are so many of us abroad right now? And how do we get back to, how will we get back to that Irish novel and talk about what's really important and what's going on in the country right now, mm-hmm. Which in many ways, and some of you know, some of you don't know, but some terrible things happening in Ireland, including roads going through, you know, very sacred places, and environmental disasters, a disregard for the past. So, like, can you take on the first part of that question, and maybe we'll move, try and segue into the second part?
Well, I mean, I think what's going on with the Irish novel is that there's no the Irish novel anymore, you know, which seems to me to be a profoundly healthy thing. I think the generation of novelists to which you and I belong is when you take all of it, which you can't really, because it isn't a school or a you know, a movement, but I think it's a big clamorous bunch of people who don't seem to be very influenced by each other, which I think is a very new thing in Ireland. When you look at all of the people who wrote at the same time as Joyce, you know, they were really all trying to do the same kind of thing. And they don't particularly seem to be influenced by the previous generations of great Irish novelists either, which is also very
good. Those ghosts on the shoulder.
Well, I think, you know, I think it must have been really hard, you know, to be writing a novel in the 1940s in Ireland with the kind of Easter Island figure of Joyce, you know, behind you. It must have been absolutely terrible.
Right.
And you can see why. You can see the tragedy, I often think, of a figure like Flann O'Brien, you know, who's a brilliant writer, but who got so caught up with kind of fireworks and technical experimentation. You know, I often think that if he had raised his eyes from Ireland, he would have written something really important, rather than just being the cult figure that he is.
That's very interesting.
So, you know, I think people are very interested in Australian writing and Indian writing, far more influenced now by modern American writing, far more of an awareness of what's actually going on in American fiction than there ever would have been in the past. They're influenced by cinema, they're influenced by television, rock music. And I think as a generation, it's probably the most interesting generation of Irish novelists ever. That's not to say that they're all very good or that they're all any good. But as a group, it's hard to think of a more fascinating group of writers. When you look at people of the skill and accomplishment of, you know, Colm Tobin, Roddy Doyle, Anne Enright, who won the Booker Prize last month, Dermot Bulger, who we've mentioned, Hugo Hamilton's book, The Speckled People, which really single-handedly reinvented how Irish memoirs are told.
Right.
You know, they seem to be breaking rules without that being a project anymore.
Which is an interesting metaphor for where we are. Let's talk about breaking rules. Let's talk about the country, Ireland, where it is right now.
Well, I don't know where it is right now because, you know, when I left it 2 weeks ago, it was at a certain place. And when I go home on Monday,
it'll be a completely different place. There'll be a new road right to the...
I think you know, Ireland is changing incredibly quickly. I mean, it is absolutely no longer the place in which you and I grew up,
right.
Which I thought was a very... Nuala O'Fallon says that, you know, her memories of growing up in Dublin in an earlier time, the 1950s, are all in monochrome. They're like a black and white movie. So it wasn't without its glamour, but it was a black and white glamour. And the rain just seemed to come down all the time, and you knew that you were being brought up in order to emigrate. And that's all that we ever talked about. It's the only reason people went to university, as far as I could see, was to postpone emigration by a few years. And then you, you know, you got your plane ticket on the same day that you got your degree, you know, with one in each hand, and off you went. And I had the strange experience I remembered very well of living in London at that in those years in the 1980s, and feeling in the intense loneliness that immigrants usually feel when I came back to Dublin for a weekend, because I didn't know anybody there anymore. They were all in New York or London or here. So there's a huge change. We have more or less full employment. We have, I think, a far more materialistic society than we used to have. But, you know, there have been great advances. One of the byproducts of the economic boom has been the beginning of immigration, as people will know. It was one of the things in the back of my mind, I suppose, when I wrote Star of the Sea. I mean, if anybody had told me that this extraordinary thing would ever happen, that people would willingly want to come to Ireland, I would have been amazed. And then my next thought would have been that they would all be welcomed with open arms precisely because of this famine history and emigration history that we never stopped singing about and telling stories about and putting up statues about. And that didn't happen. You know, and I don't think the Irish are a nation of racists, or I don't think they're particularly xenophobic. But the figures, as far as we could see, are pretty similar as they would have been in other countries with a colonial past. So that kind of interested me. So Ireland's becoming a multicultural very, very rapidly. The census figures, which came out a few weeks ago, revealed 10% of people living in the country now were born somewhere else. And interestingly, just the day I came over, the workforce figures were released, and it was 17%. So, you know, more of them are working than are Irish. So, you know, you hear new languages, you see new cultures, new belief systems. I think certainly by the time my children are my age, the preoccupations of the Ireland in which I grew up, some of which were very good, you know, will have disappeared, and there will be new things that people worry about. There will be new languages, as I said. I mean, I have close friends who are interested in the Irish language. I don't know whether it's a good time for the Irish language or not, but there will certainly be many new languages, many new cultures, and many new belief systems, and it's already happening, so we'd better just get used to it, you know? I think it's a very good thing, but even people who don't, I'd better get used to it.
Well, see, it strikes me that either consciously or unconsciously, Irish novelists and Irish poets have been concentrating or moving towards the other in exactly to reflect what is happening in Irish society at this particular moment, so that the movement outside of the borders is reflective of the movement into one's borders. And you know, it used to be when we grew up, like half our classes, we grew up both in Dublin at the exact same time, half our classes would emigrate. And the big problem was leaving. People like would be crying at the airport and everything. Nobody cries at the airport anymore. Not at all. And it strikes me that the quote for now is the Brodsky quote: "You can't go back to the country that doesn't exist anymore." And so we must react against some of the nostalgia that establishes, you know, Ireland as it is, and then look for new stories.
Well, I mean, for me, it's easily done. I mean, there is a certain kind of Irish nostalgia that sometimes does make its way into literary endeavour, and you know, I think it should be resisted. Like, overall, I think generally for most people, Ireland now is a much healthier, more confident, more interesting, more outward-looking place than it has ever been. There is peace in the north of Ireland, which, you know, when we were children, really was fantasy land. You know, that was never going to happen. That was just one of those problems that would always be there. You know, people have jobs, people have options. You know, I mean, I think the materialism that there is, you know, which is definitely there, it's just something that happens when people have been poor for a long time. They get a few quid, they go crazy, and they want to go to the toy shop. I do think we've had 10 years of it now, so it's now time to, you know, the party should be over, and we need to decide, are we going to have a health system, for example, and, you know, interesting Scandinavian things like that, you know.
Can I ask you a weird question, like completely, maybe it goes back to this. What were you like when you were 9 years old?
I don't remember.
Was there a fridge full of rich things?
I can't remember ever seeing a fridge full of anything in Ireland in those days. I was a very bookish little fella. You know, I liked books and reading. And I think one of the cliches of Irish life that's true is that, you know, in most Irish homes, certainly at the time, and I think still, there was some notion that to be an authentic human being, you should have some interest in the arts, you know. Right. And my parents, who were both Dublin working class people, left school at the age of 13, not much formal education at that time. But, you know, there were books in the house and they took us to the theatre and there was nothing sort of odd about it. I mean, I've often had the conversation with English colleagues who write or with people from other countries about the dreadful day they went home and told mum and dad, you know, guess what, I want to be a novelist. And, you know, the smelling salts had to be there. You know, I think most Irish families would not regard that as a particularly strange thing to want to do. So, you know, I can remember John McGahern's books being in the house, Benedict Kiley, who I know you admired very much, you know, a great interest in his work. I mean, it's kind of how I started writing. I can remember slightly older than nine, when I was 13 or 14, really wanting to write, you know. And there was a John McGahern book that came out in 1975 called Getting Through. It's a collection of short stories. And there was a story in that book that I really loved called Sierra Leone. And it's a story about a troubled couple who meet in a Dublin pub once a week to discuss their relationship. So I was 12 or 13. I was very interested in troubled relationships, you know. And so I remember sitting in my bedroom one night with like my school copybook and my pencil, the school copybook with the map of Ireland on the front of it, you know, and thinking, like, what can I write? You know, here I am living in Glenageary, a suburb of Dublin, and nothing ever happens. John McGahern has all this interesting stuff down in Leitrim to write about. Old bachelors who used to be in the IRA, and, you know, old maids on their bicycles, and nothing ever happens here. You know, somebody gets out the lawnmower here on a Saturday afternoon, and that's it. We all gather around to watch. So I thought, well, what I'll do is I'll actually just write out Sierra Leone, word for word. So I did that in my school copybook, just to feel what that was like to write these beautiful sentences. It's a bit like, I suppose, the wannabe pop star playing a tennis racket in the mirror, you know. Yeah. So I did that, and that was great. And then a couple of nights later, I did it again. But this time, I changed the name of one of the characters. I gave him my father's name, Sean. And another character, I remember, I had a crush on Debbie Harry, the punk singer at the time. So Debbie was one of the women in the story. And then a few nights later, you can see I had a very sad adolescence. I did this again. So that every kind of week or so over a couple of years, I would rewrite this story until I had sort of married this couple and moved them to the suburbs in a house pretty like mine, where they had a lawnmower on a Saturday afternoon. And at some point, the balance sort of tilted, and it became 51% my story. And I told John McGahern this once, and he said, you know, you really owe me a few pints. So you know, I ruined this perfectly beautiful story.
That story didn't make it into your first collection, Cowboys.
Well, it did. My second book, which is a collection of short stories called True Believers, the title story in that book is the story that I began to write when I was 13.
Is that the one with the guy with the mohawk on the front? Yeah.
And when you place these texts, you know, side by side, you can't see how one of them could possibly have grown out from the other, but it did.
But we get our voice from the voices of others, and I'd like to ask you about that. You talk about McGahern. Who else do you have this scrawl for?
Well, I suppose the Irish writer of, you know, the generation immediately before ours who meant most to me was Brian Moore. He was somebody who I just loved. McGahern's work was fantastic, and he was a genius, and he never published anything that wasn't a masterpiece. Brian Moore was a different kind of writer in that he was somebody who just believed in the craft and he just kept going. And, you know, he got out of Ireland when he was a young man, got out of Belfast, went to live in Canada, lived in Malibu for a while, which I thought was a fantastic thing. I think far more Irish writers should go and live in Malibu. And he wrote a novel every 2 years or every 3 years. And, you know, some of them were fantastic and were shortlisted for the Booker Prize. Some of them not quite so good, but, you know, you knew there was always another one coming. He wasn't afraid of genres. Mm-hmm. He wasn't afraid of love stories, thrillers, historical fiction. I had the great honor of interviewing him for the Sunday Tribune in Ireland not long before he died. And I just thought he was in some ways...
He said the amazing thing in an interview. He said, you know where you're from when you know when you want to be buried. And this is the thing. He was in Canada.
Malibu.
He was in California. No. But
that's
he ended
not
up
talking about me.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He wanted to be buried. So you're from Malibu. You're a California boy. But Brian Moore Brian Moore had decided that he wanted to be buried on a headland back up in Northern Ireland. Hadn't been back to Northern Ireland in years and years and years. Mm. And he said, you know where you're from when you know where you want to finally rest.
Yeah. It's either Malibu or the Cullman Centre upstairs. I'd like my ashes to be placed in office number 13.
Yeah, we just throw them out the window.
So I love Brian Moore. And then I suppose we all have, you know, the book that made us want to write. And in my case, that was, like probably many other people's case, it was The Catcher in the Rye, you know, mm. Salinger's great novel, which somebody gave me when I was 16. And I can remember the moment of turning over the last page and just thinking, well, that's it. I'd love to do that. And, you know, when you read a book when you're that age, you know, the fantastic, sarcastic tone of the narrator, Holden Caulfield, if I can paraphrase the opening paragraph where he talks about, you know, I suppose you want to know who I am and where I'm from and what my parents did for a living and all that other Charles Dickens crap. And, you know, you're in a school in Ireland and the only novels on the course are Charles Dickens crap. And you think, wow, like this is, you know, 200 years.
Charles Dickens was crap for many years, right?
Well, I have a love-hate relationship with Dickens. Do you want me to tell you about it? Or?
No, I know a bit about it because you can feel it actually in the books. You can feel it happening in Star of the Sea, and then you can feel it in it. There's even the torn page of Great Expectations in this book. It seems to me, I mean, I can see the love of Dickens. Mm. I'd be much rather interested in the hate. Just talk about the hate.
Just the hate. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, I have to contextualize the hate, I have to have 15 seconds of love. Dickens is, you know, the greatest storyteller ever. He is brilliant at moving his characters around like chess pieces on a board. He can get them into any situation that you want. He creates extremely vivid characters who are kind of etched on our consciousness. Even people who don't read know who Fagin is and who Oliver Twist is. Probably because of the movies, but even that, you know, it tells you something. His characters are just so alive. They don't make any psychological sense at all. There isn't a credible woman in the entire canon of Dickens. The way that you can illustrate it most economically is if you look at Oliver Twist. Here's a novel about a boy who is born in a workhouse. His mother dies giving birth to him. He is dragged up in this workhouse, beaten, starved, spat upon. It's a classic abusive childhood. If he was around now, he'd be on Oprah, you know, with his memoir about it. He escapes from there, runs off to London, where he's brought up by prostitutes and thieves, and he becomes a burglar and a thief, and it's terrible experiences. And all the way through the book, he talks like a little member of the British royal family.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And he never swears, he never blasphemes, he never has an unmanly thought. And you're reading this thinking, Jesus, how, like, what is this
Because he's
child?
An aristocrat at heart.
Well, that's it. You know, you realize at the end, when Oliver is revealed to be the child of an aristocrat, that Dickens just can't bear that the child of an aristocrat would talk in the same way as the oiks. Mm. So that the book embodies the very snobbery that it's very energetically railing against. So I think that's true always with Dickens. But if you're looking for a writer who believed in language, who can make the French Revolution happen on the page, I mean, the extraordinary energy that the writers of that era had, you know, it's almost like a punk thing. You know, the rules of the novel haven't been set in stone yet. Right. And there's a capaciousness and an ambition for language that wasn't there, I think, in the writers who were around when I started writing. Brilliant writers though they were, people like Raymond Carver and the American sort of dirty realists. But there was a stage when we were all writing our short stories where nothing ever happened. Mm. And if a reviewer said nothing happens in this story, yes, that would be seen as a good thing. Yeah.
And nothing is said even.
I think Dickens would have been horrified by that.
How would Dickens have dealt with the Cullman Centre?
By staying in his office a lot.
Which you did, apparently.
Yeah, no, I mean, I love.
Talk to us
Cullman
about
Center.
The experience.
Well,
the
I just, I mean, I said to some people earlier that I walked past the building today and I considered dropping in, but I couldn't because I just thought that it would be embarrassing if I wept and knelt down and kissed the ground. And, I mean, I had a fantastic time at the Cullman Centre. It's a wonderful place. It was very difficult to leave, Jean. And, you know, for many months afterwards, I felt like the way we do when, you know, a very passionate love affair has ended, you've been dumped. I would often find late at night that I wanted to drink half a bottle of vodka and call the Cullman Centre and say, please, would you take me back? You know, I can change. So you know, it was just an absolute, as you know, because you were there yourself. It was a year of just the most extraordinary privileges, and you know, it was a fantastic place to work. It's the ideal way for an out-of-towner, you know, to be here in New York, because you know there are 15 fellows on this course, so it provides you with 14 other people to talk to. Right. You know, there were some amazing people on the fellowship with me. Some of them are here tonight, you know, so you have these 14 very diverse and interesting personalities to deal with on a Monday morning, and that's just Edmund White actually all by himself.
Yeah.
So it was
he's 15 men it was, all
it was just absolutely great. I mean, I have to say, I can't allow the evening to pass without saying what we all know, that the wonderful treasures of this place are nothing compared to, you know, the ultimate resource here, which is the librarians. Exactly. And their knowledge and their generosity and the love, you know, it's the only word that for that they bring to what they do. I mean, I found, you know, when I was dealing with people here, once they knew what I was working on, the stuff would just appear on my desk. I mean, it got to the point that I didn't even have to ask. People would come and suggest, you know, why don't you look at this, why don't you look at that. I remember having a conversation with a young man who works in the map department, and part of this book is set in Montana in 1867. So I said to him, I wonder, would it be possible, you know, do you possibly have somewhere in the basement a map of Montana in 1867? And when I came in the next day, it's on my desk, you know. And just their absolute commitment, you know, to what they
sure.
do. And
I dedicated Zoli to librarians and librarians in general, because it seems to me that they're heroic and they don't get properly acknowledged. Thankfully, you're acknowledging them. Translators too don't get properly acknowledged.
Yeah.
And I want to move.
Neither do we, of course.
Of course we do. Jeez, we get too much acknowledgement.
But we're on who's not being acknowledged.
Yeah.
No? I don't know if anyone else feels unacknowledged, but tonight's your night, you know.
Talking about like translation and movement and things, there's one thing I want to ask you about. Ian McEwan talks about adapting his books as a sort of form of hooliganism. Mm-hmm. That you know, if he adapts his books to film, he feels like he just gets in there with a scalpel and chops away, and he can never come out with something that's quite as powerful in the cinematic version as he has done in his literary version. Now, you write in quite a profound cinematographic way. It strikes me that you create photographs, you create moving pictures into which the reader walks and walks around. That's as a literary technique, but I also know that you're adapting this particular book for the films, right?
Well, I'm not going to write the screenplay myself.
You know?
I've no interest in doing that, and I'm not adapting the screenplay of Star of the Sea.
Even though you've done 3 or 4 screenplays?
Yeah, I have, and I like writing screenplays, and you know, I'm working on a few other things. I'm adapting a very interesting Somerset Maugham novel called The Magician for a screenplay. But I'm with Ian McEwan, really, and you know, I suppose I have a sort of secret theory that a really good book can't be adapted, you know, because the novelist chose for it to be a novel and used those strategies and those rules. And if he or she wanted to write a screenplay, you know, I think they would have. And I think you can always see when a novel is a screenplay waiting to happen, you know, and it's often not a very good book. So although my bank manager and my mortgage company would love Redemption Falls to be a successful movie, and so would I. No, I needn't add, because I'm aware this is being filmed and maybe podcast sometime,
yeah,
so it's not that private. So I'd like it to happen, but I wouldn't like to be involved in it myself, really. You know, I think learning to be a good novelist is enough of a challenge for one life, you know. And I don't mind doing original screenplays and adaptations of other people's books, but I don't really want to do mine.
Right. We were talking earlier today and talking about you know, how a novelist actually, you know, gets by, and I was saying to Joe that Jim Harrison, the poet from
Montana, now lives in New Mexico. He says, children pry up our rotting bodies with cries of earn, earn, earn. And the fact of the matter is, we do have to make a living as novelists. Now, I'm aware that I want to open it up to the audience here in just a minute. Joe, this is the second part of a trilogy.
Yes, it is, yeah.
Can you just tell us a little bit
about
it?
I'll tell you the 60-second version of the third part. In the last few years of his life, the great Irish playwright J.M. Singh had a love affair with a much younger woman called Molly Allgood, who was an actress at the Abbey Theatre, which Singh had, of course, helped to found with Yeats and Lady Gregory. And it was largely a secret affair. Their families they knew about it, but they weren't crazy about the idea. Singh was from, you know, an Anglo-Irish ascendancy, landowning background. Molly Allgood was from a Dublin working-class background, was Catholic, so there was all of that. So they conducted this affair in secret. Even Yeats and Lady Gregory were not that crazy about it, which I find very interesting in that they liked plays in which poor Irish people were appearing on the stage in very noble light, but it's just the idea that you might be sleeping with one of them, you know, it wasn't so good. So they conducted this affair in great secret, Singh constantly waiting for his mother to die, and hoping that when his mother died, that would be mother out of the way, and also he would inherit her money, and they would get a little house in the suburbs and live together. And like a lot of people waiting for their mother to die, Singh died. And so Molly lived to be a ripe old age, to about 1955, I think. So it's the era of rock and roll. Space travel is just around the corner. She had an amazing life here in America. She appeared in Hitchcock's second film, which was an adaptation of O'Casey's Juno and the Paycock. She died in a basement of the BBC in London, recording a radio version of a play written by Singh. So she never escaped from this man.
Wow.
And I think I want to make it a very short novel with one voice, so different from these big, big symphonic books. And a novel really about her, but also about how America dealt with Ireland in the end, which is by putting it on the stage. Mm. And I suppose if Ireland joins the sort of circus of stereotypes and we're all dancing away with the green wigs on, then the Star of the Sea stories never happened and the Redemption Falls stories never happened. And, you know, a new myth is put in its place. So I'd like that to be the third part of this trilogy, and then I'd like to write a novel set in 2007 in Dublin, and no more historical research for a while.
I'd like to see all three of them like together, but carrying around like War and Peace.
Well, that's why the third one is going to be so short, because just the idea of binding together three of these would just be a terrible thing to drop on your foot.
Well, you know, they are beautiful novels. They're really great. I'd love to see all three of them together at some stage. Now, I'd really like to open it up to you guys. We have a microphone here. So, first question is always the bravest one. Sir.
Picking up on the thought of the expansion of the Irish novels, my first reaction when I thought about coming tonight was, why the Civil War? How did that enter your mind as something to talk about? Mm-hmm. To me, I think of it as something purely American, and yet this Irish novelist comes in and thinks about it and talks about it and speaks to it, and to me that's kind of fascinating. I'm just wondering if you comment.
Sure. Well, I mean, the American Civil War is interesting for so many reasons. We could have the whole evening and a whole series of evenings just on that subject. But one of the things that's very interesting about it is the enormous number of immigrants who fought in the war, perhaps 200,000 on the northern side. And as you know, there were all Irish brigades organized by people like Thomas Francis Marr. And you have people, even more interesting in some ways, perhaps 80,000 fighting for the South, this is the pro-slavery side. So in the case of someone like John Mitchell, you know, back at home in Ireland, he's revolutionary, democratic, and influenced by the French revolutionary ideals and so on. And in the South, appears to me, I mean, they're far more learned historians here than myself, but appears to me to be what we would now call a white supremacist. So it's how those journeys happened are very interesting. And I also think that the American Civil War is a hugely important event in terms of the story of Irish assimilation into mainstream American life. That up until the war, you have quite an amount of anti-Irish prejudice. The Irish poor suffer similar forms of prejudice as other immigrant groups do, as African American slaves do, although it's obviously not quite the same. This is really the shorthand version now. After the war, in which they've participated in such enormous numbers, I think they feel, well, look, you know, we fought in your war. We can't be regarded as outsiders anymore. You know, we have tens of thousands of Irish people dying, sometimes fighting each other. I mean, there are remarkable stories, for example, of the Battle of Fredericksburg, where the frontline troops in one engagement of that battle at Mary's Heights, the frontline troops on both sides are Irish, you know, from New York for the north, and I think from Georgia for the south.
Do you remember the Ralph Harris song, Two Little Boys or Two Little Toys?
Yeah.
It's an American Civil War song.
They're fighting each other in this battlefield in Virginia in a war that wasn't of their making. You know, it's just hugely interesting and fascinating why they would want to, and there's the poignancy of that. And, you know, some of the research that I did here at the library about that is very interesting. When you read the soldiers' letters, all of the different reasons that people had for joining up, some, you know, out of a great loyalty to the new country, the country that they thought had given them freedom, and others for the money, and others for all sorts of reasons. A particularly poignant thing that I saw in some of their letters, particularly among younger men, was the idea of wanting to see some of America. You know, there are often people who have come from one little townland in Ireland, might never have left it for the first 15 years of their life, and they undergo the terrible voyage, you know, that I wrote about in Star of the Sea, and they get to New York or Boston. And then they keep hearing about this huge country, you know, that goes all the way down to, you know, the south and over to California, and, you know, let's go and have a look at it. And we'll go down to Virginia and we'll kick the rebels' asses and we'll be home by Christmas. And they don't realize, like, it's the pre-mass media age. They have no idea, really, of the horrors of war, as some of the generals themselves don't. I mean, as I don't think Thomas Francis Marr did. I think he was absolutely harrowed by what happened in the war. So you see that kind of note again and again. So it's a huge part of your story, but it's a huge part of our story too. And while there have been one or two novels about it before, I just wanted to have a crack at it myself, you know.
Another question? I know we had one over here somewhere. Is there a question over here?
So in the language that are not lots of word choices that were not sort of wall off in this town. And that stops. Mm-hmm. But it seemed like there was intentional. I'm curious if it was intentional, how those words came in, and if you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I absolutely know what you're talking about. It sounds like a great book. I suppose when I was structuring the book, I was trying to think, you know, that each character should have their own music. So the way that Eliza Mooney thinks is not the same as the very scientific cartographer Alan Winterton thinks. I don't know if you got as far as that yet. But about a third from the end, you know, this new character arrives who's very measured. He's a man of science. He prides himself on writing in an extremely specific way. Eliza's brother, Jeddo, who's been brought up in Baton Rouge, his head is kind of a jumble of Irish words, bits of folklore, bits of blues and gospel language that he's heard from the slaves. You know, so, and then O'Keefe, you know, is very much the public man. He's an orator. He thinks very carefully about how he presents himself. So I wanted each character to have their own kind of music. So at every point that you meet Eliza, the sort of tone becomes a bit more like that, like it is in the opening pages. So keep going would be my advice.
Any other questions there? Joe, I wanted to ask you, you said yourself that the novel records the indefatigable grace of human compassion.
Yeah. That's a mouthful, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a mouthful. Are you a sentimentalist?
No, I hope not. But, I think you do see that people are sometimes capable of extraordinary acts of generosity. Right. And Eliza is, I think that's what ties the book together, in that she goes on this enormous journey to find this child who she doesn't even particularly like. You know, Jeddo, her brother, is described as being a very difficult little fellow indeed, but she just is motivated by some kind of morality that has somehow survived despite all of the abuses that she's been through. And I think there should be more novels about that.
Sure, know? And that grace comes through. That grace absolutely comes through. Then do you see yourself as a social novelist?
I don't really see myself as anything, really, to be honest. I see myself as a much thinner novelist than I used to be.
Yeah, you're half the size. So
here's where it all went, you know. I don't think in those sort of terms. I think that's the language of the critic and the academic. And I respect people who do that. But it's just, you know, I see myself as a storyteller, and that's really, you know, first and last.
And this is part of the human democracy, that everybody has a deep need to tell a story and across boundaries, well, genders. I mean, you're going across all sorts of things. You're going into a woman's voice. You're going into voices from different.
Yeah, Jean wants us to stop.
Oh, she wants us to stop. You'll give me 10 like that. Oh, okay. All right, right. So we have
when
to stop,
Jean
unfortunately.
Wants us to stop, we have
when
to Jean, stop.
Yeah, yeah. So. Listen, thank you so much.
Thank you very
fantastic.
Much.
Fantastic. And thank you. Signing books. You gave me 10.